Welcome to the teleclass Basic Microbiology. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I will say that we are delighted that you have joined us for this teleclass today, particularly if this is your first teleclass experience. The teleclass organizing committee for North America consists of Sharon Christofiak, Jackie Daly, and myself, and we decided last year that we would like to run a series of teleclasses specifically for novice practitioners. We looked at an appropriate list of topics and then went looking for the best presenter for each topic. Today's teleclass is the first in the novice series, and for the topic of microbiology, we all agreed unanimously right away that the very best person for this teleclass is Jim Gauthier. Jim is an ICP in Kingston, Ontario, Canada. He works in a very large mental health care facility. His background is in the microbiology lab, and he is an extremely popular speaker all over North America. He is intelligent, articulate, and creative. If you've been to one of his lectures, you have probably seen him sing or tap dance or use theater. He uses anything to effectively communicate his message. And if you go to the recordings library on the Weber Training website and type in his name, you'll see that he has given two teleclasses before, including a very famous, almost notorious lecture called The Physics of Flying Feces. I've been pleased to call Jim my friend for many years, and it is an honor to be able to welcome him back to give this teleclass. So from the thriving metropolis of Kingston, Ontario, to present basic microbiology, it is my pleasure to present the one and absolutely only Jim Gauthier. Jim.
Thank you, Paul, very much for that introduction. I can always expect you to whip out the thesaurus every time I am presenting for you and come up with even new words for me that I haven't heard before. I'm looking forward to this presentation. This is a talk that I've done before for much smaller crowds, and I've used my years of background of working in the laboratory on the frontline bench and recognizing the issues of trying to explain to people what I actually do for a living and what their end of the job was in terms of getting me good specimens and how to interpret a lot of what I sent back. So this is a component of what I actually present in terms of the basic microbiology and understanding what goes on in a bug man's world. Because we do live in a really small, isolated area in the laboratory, usually in the bowels of some hospital. The component talk that would go with this is on how to take a swab and how to do an effective swabbing. And I'm actually going to be doing a presentation at our upcoming Canadian National Conference at the CICA Conference on that, aiming it at infection control practitioners. So if we proceed to the my objective slide that you have, what I'm trying to do is to make sure that everyone is much easier with the terminology that we tend to use from the laboratory. We use short forms, we use short forms of names, we use acronyms, and I want to try to make sure that people are comfortable with what's happening here. A very important component of microbiology is also making sure that you understand the difference between normal flora and flora that can cause problems or is causing problems. What I've listed here is abnormal flora. Trying to demystify all the Latin and the Greek, I still have trouble. Every time I go back and take a good look at what's happening in microbiology, they've changed the names again. And it seems to be a constant kind of thing, I think, for the institutional microbiologists that they get a little tired of having something named the same way for more than a couple of years. So off we go and change the names again. And I'll bring some of that up as we go through the organisms that I'm going to talk about. I do have photomicrographs in the presentation. Those of you that are looking at this off of a black and white print won't have the same pump to it that you would get as if you were viewing it up here on the screen. So if we go to the next slide and look at the basics, I'm going to go through a whole bunch of basics about microbiology and bacteria. I will talk a little bit about viruses at the end of the presentation. So we got to start off with recognizing that it is called microbiology for a real good reason in that the bugs are small, 2 to 5 microns. Being a Canadian, I can't convert that for you into inches, but I know it's really tiny, 10 to the minus 6 of a meter. And viruses, when we do talk about those, are even smaller. You can't visualize those with a regular light microscope in your basic laboratory. When we work with organisms, we're looking at basically three things. What do they look like under the microscope? What is their shape? How do they color on the microscope when we use the Gram stain that I will talk about? And how do they grow? What do they require? The next slide goes on to explain a little bit more about microscopes. When we look at an organism, we're getting the phenotypic view. What you can see is basically always the definition I use of what is a phenotype. When you actually start playing with the organism and finding out what it likes to do in terms of growing and stuff like that, what atmosphere it likes, what sugars it's able to ferment, we start to get into the genotypic view of the organism. And a lot of the genotype is based on what it is, based on its genetics and stuff like that. One of the basics of microbiology that always amazed me as a microbiology tech is most people want the results yesterday. So many times you would receive a swab in the laboratory in the morning and the staff phone down in the afternoon saying, what do you got? Now we're getting better with some of the tests that I'm talking about when we get into the PCR issues and stuff like that, but generally speaking, this is not a quick science. So if we go to the next slide, I explain why we're not quick. Most of our pathogenic bacteria take 18 to 24 hours to grow. Enough that I can actually see them in the laboratory and to say, yes, there is a bacteria here that I now have to do something with. So once we have that 18 to 24 hours go, so I put an organism on a plate today, about 2 in the afternoon, tomorrow morning I look at the plate and go, ah, there is something here, my goodness, this looks like, for instance, Staph aureus. I would take it to another testing setup, and in 4 to 24 hours, I would be able to tell the doctor, this is a Staph aureus and it is sensitive to oxacillin. For instance, to do the full identification with some organisms can take an additional 24 to 48 hours after that point. It depends on the organism. It depends on the technologies that we actually have in our laboratory, how long some of this stuff actually does take. But it's not a quick science. We're getting better, I have to admit. There's new tests coming out. If you go to the next slide titled Identification, we utilize a lot of things in the laboratory to tell us, or to get the organism to tell us what it is. We make it work in the sense that we want to find out, can you grow in the presence of oxygen or not? So we would do that. We'll put it in an oxygen-free atmosphere or anaerobic atmosphere and see if it can survive or not. We check it with various sugars and pH indicators back from your grade 10 science days. We try to find out if it can ferment or oxidize sugars, producing acid end products, which we then detect with our pH indicators that we use in these various tests. We like to see what temperature ranges the organisms can grow at because we have pathogenic bacteria that can grow at refrigerator temperature of 4 degrees Celsius, right up to organisms that can tolerate quite easily 56 degrees Celsius, which is much hotter than most of us that can survive unless you're in the Australian outback. Salt tolerance is another test that we can use to see if it can grow in the presence of regular sodium chloride that we would use in a saline compound of 0.9%, and we will test it up to 4 to 6% to see if it can actually tolerate that also. We have various chemicals that we can play with. We have enzymes that we can try to detect by the end products that the organisms produce. And in some cases, we just want to see whether the bacteria can actually move by itself. So by using this battery of things, we get the organism to tell us what it is by accepted testing and end products of what we know. If you move on to the next slide of identification again, we have come a long way. We now have a lot of polymerase chain reactions that we can actually go and look at the bacteria at a genetic level and find out what it is reasonably quick. I know here in Kingston we have an MRSA test with a turnaround time of around 3 hours where they actually use a PCR test and it can say yes or no, there is MRSA present here or not. Other tests that have been around a lot longer than these newer tests for MRSA and VRE include tests for some of our sexually transmitted infections such as chlamydia and gonorrhea and organisms like tuberculosis. There are newer tests out now for norovirus that are just coming online that are showing great promise and a much quicker turnaround time and sensitivity than what we used to get with the traditional electron microscopy. ELISA tests have been around for a while. Those are enzyme-linked immunosorbent assays, is what ELISA stands for. We try to make the organism an antigen and have it react with an antibody. And some of these tests that we utilize ELISA tests for are when we're looking for organisms such as influenza, RSV, and rotavirus. You notice all three of those are viruses, what we're trying to detect, because they don't grow well. First of all, they don't grow in culture as such. You have to use tissue cells from various sources to get viruses to grow, and it's a very slow process. So if we can actually try to detect that yes or no the virus is present or not, it makes it much quicker to have this kind of identification happen. So my next slide, we're going to look at some of the basic terms that I like to use around our organisms. And we tend to throw these terms out without recognizing that we're using a foreign language. So when we're testing to see whether bacteria can grow in the presence of oxygen or not, if it grows in oxygen, we call it an aerobic bacteria, and some of our more common bacteria that are aerobic are Pseudomonas and Bacillus. Bacillus isn't a huge issue in our patients, but it causes a lot of contamination in the laboratory. If it doesn't grow in the presence of oxygen, we have an anaerobic bacteria, and that would include genus such as Clostridium and Bacteroides. If it can grow in either oxygen or without oxygen, we call it a facultative anaerobe, and that's our organism such as E. coli, which I'm sure is familiar to all the listeners, is one of our more common enteric or gut flora organisms. It doesn't matter where it's growing. It actually prefers to grow. It looks a little better when it grows anaerobically. And some bacteria, such as Pseudomonas, will actually produce a colony anaerobically, but it just doesn't grow well there at all. And it's an experienced kind of thing that you pick up that, oh my goodness, that looks like Pseudomonas on my anaerobic plate. And when you go to the aerobic one, you have this luxurious growth to figure out what it actually is. The next slide looks at another term that we use a lot, which is hemolysis. You will hear the term beta-hemolytic streptococci, for instance. Beta-hemolysis is referring to the complete destruction. What we actually do is we take the organism, put it on an agar plate that has sheep blood in it. And we also use other species of blood, but generally speaking, most of the stuff I was familiar with were sheep blood plates. And we just look to see whether the organism, while it's growing, clears or digests the red blood cells that are around it. And I've got a picture coming up here to show that. So if it completely digests the red cells and you have this little clear area around the colony, we refer to that as beta, or complete destruction of the cells. If you get sort of a partial digestion and it's sort of a greeny color around the colony, we refer to that as alpha hemolysis, and you'll hear the term alpha hemolytic streptococci when we refer to things like normal flora in the mouth. And there is a term that still kicks around called gamma hemolysis, where there is no hemolysis, which most of us in the laboratory usually just say it's not hemolytic. But that term does pop up every once in a while, so I thought I would include that on my slide. The next slide in color looks wonderful because I have a nice beta symbol with a clearing around it in black and white. That shows up not too bad. The alpha symbol is also shown there on color. You've got the greening around it, and underneath black and white it doesn't show up. There looks like a check mark or a gamma sign showing no digestion at all of the blood plate. So we go to the next slide. Another term that we use a lot is catalase. Catalase is a test where we're looking for that enzyme, the enzyme catalase. I've just been helping one of my grade 12 students with some work around proteins and stuff like that, and the term catalase comes up. But our organisms, we're checking to see whether it actually has this enzyme present as part of its mechanisms for surviving. And all we do is literally take the organism and mix it in a drop of hydrogen peroxide. If it has catalase, the catalase breaks down the hydrogen peroxide to water and oxygen, and you get bubbling that actually happens. This test is the main distinguishing feature between staphylococci and other gram-positive cocci, such as the streptococci or the enterococci, with staphylococci being catalase positive and your streptococci / enterococci being catalase negative. A very simple test. It was always reasonably entertaining in the laboratory to do because you got a chance to make a little fizzy broth on your desktop. And again, small things amuse my small mind. The basic terms goes on to talk about coagulase on the next slide, because we also use this expression a lot, that we refer to an organism that is coagulase positive, or more commonly, the coagulase negative staph. Coagulase is another enzyme present in some organisms, and this enzyme actually has the ability to clot or clump or coagulate rabbit plasma. Again, generally that was the species that we used in the laboratory. And when you mix the organism in a solution of rabbit plasma, incubate it for 4 hours to 24 hours. If it has the coagulase enzyme, it actually, when you go to look at the tube, it's solid. It makes a little gel suspension of it. We've modernized that because it was hard on the rabbits, and we came up with mixing the protein component of it to plasma or latex, using latex particles so that the latex particles actually clumped together, and it was much more rapid of a test, so you didn't have to have the 4 to 24-hour incubation. And this is the main identifying feature of Staphylococcus aureus, that is coagulase positive, and it distinguishes it from everything else, and hence that category of coagulase negative staph. That's sort of the scientific way of saying it's not staph aureus. The next slide is a photomicrograph again, or not, it's a picture of the slide test that we would use for coagulase. On the left-hand slide, you can see the clumping of the white latex particles showing that it's coagulase positive. On the right-hand side, there is just a homogeneous growth, and you just rock this back and forth. And it's that rapid that as you rock it back and forth, it would clot up on you and give you a chance to see it. The next picture is of a tube test that we would do for coagulase where it has been incubated. You have to check these at 4 hours because there are some strains of Staph aureus that will actually redigest itself. So it will be positive 4 but negative in 24. On the left-hand side, you can see the clot at the bottom where the protein component of the plasma has settled out, and on the right-hand side, it's negative. There is no clotting to it. The next slide that I put up here is something I drew. It's amazing what you can actually do with PowerPoint, and it shows how we quantitate the growth of organisms. So up where it shows the 1 plus at the top of the slide is where we would actually take the swab and roll it around on our agar plate, depending on what plate we're actually using, depending on what sample it's coming from. We then streak through that area with our loop and turn the plate, and then drag out more and turn the plate and drag out more and turn the plate and drag out more. If we can drag the growth all the way around to the fourth quadrant, that is referred to as 4-plus growth or heavy growth. If it only comes out, if we only drag the organism out to the other areas marked, that's how we report it. So when you hear the term of light growth or 1-plus growth, depending on your laboratory, it's indicating there was only enough organism present on the specimen to come into that mean area that we had put it onto the plate. If we can drag it farther out, because there's lots of it there, it just indicates there's a heavier growth. So that's where the quantitation comes from. Not that subjective. Most lab techs are pretty consistent within one growth range of what is happening and how we call that. A little trivia point on the bottom of the slide here, that solidified growth media was first used by Robert Koch back in the late 1800s, and that was on the advice of one of his lab mate's wife, commented that she used this product at home that was an extract of seaweed called agar to help thicken up some of her solutions. They did try using gelatin, but there's a lot of organisms that can actually digest gelatin, and if you had that in your plate when you come in the morning, your plate is all liquid. So we got away from that, and still, as far as I know, we don't have an organism that will digest agar. So it's still used consistently to this day. The next slide has, again, some pictures of agar plates. It's just showing various manifestations of what these plates can look like, depending if they're selective plates, trying to eliminate some of the normal flora that are present. The plate on the right-hand side is a normal blood plate that's been smeared and streaked out, and you can see that you eventually do get the single colonies out into what would be the 4-plus growth range. The next slide is a busy little slide, but it gives you an idea of the naming of the bacteria and how it works. So we look at the bacterial morphologies, or the shape, and we can have a straight rod shape, club-shaped, branching shapes, comma forms, rods that actually have a spore inside of them, we have spiral forms, and we have the round shape, or the coccus. And on the right-hand side, it gives you an example of each of these organisms as you work your way down. And a lot of this is what we were looking for in the microscope. The bottom half of the slide where it talks about cell arrangement just shows that once you have a single coccus, when you get more of them, they can take on various forms. Your diplococci divide in a plane, and you end up with two cocci stuck together that are actually flattened on one side, very characteristic of the Neisseria species. If the bacteria divide and form a chain, we refer to it as streptococcus, or other names that we have now gone into the genus of enterococci, but that's just a split off of the streptococci. To me, strepto still means chain. Your cluster at the bottom is typical of a staphylococcus, and again, when I hear the word staph, I always think of a clump of bacteria. Again, so we're looking under the microscope. What is the shape? How do they actually form up under the microscope? And just from doing that, we get a good idea of what we're working with. So if I go to the next slide, the Gram stain is the workhorse of the laboratory. Developed in the late 1800s, it is actually named after the doctor that discovered it. He was a pathologist that was playing around with various staining techniques, and he noticed that while staining lung tissue, that there were certain organisms that would retain the stain when he was trying to get rid of it, trying to decolorize the stain off. Organisms that are considered Gram-positive organisms are purple in color, and that was always easy for all of us microbiology tech because purple and positive start with P. Your Gram-negative organisms are red in color or whatever counter stain that you actually use. There are some labs that use a malachite green counter stain, so their Gram-negative organisms would actually be green. But pretty traditionally, most of the time we're looking at either purple for Gram-positive and red for Gram-negative. And this is all based on the cell wall composition. On the next slide, on your left-hand side, you have the Gram-negative organisms. I'm just seeing what this looks like in black and white. The thicker part of the right-hand side is the Gram-positive, and that's the peptidoglycan layer of the organism. So in Gram-positive cocci, they have a very thick layer that retains the stain. And the staining process is you put crystal violet on the slide, let it sit there. You wash that off with an iodine solution, and iodine and crystal violet forms this complex that sticks to the peptidoglycan layer. We then pour alcohol and a combination of alcohol and acetone over the organism, which will wash it off of organisms that don't have a great peptidoglycan layer. So if you have a good layer there, it holds on to that stain and that complex. If it doesn't have that good layer there, you wash it off, you put on your counter stain, and then you find out that it's gram-negative because it did lose the stain. So it's all based on cell wall. So we look at the gram stain. It gives us a really quick look at the specimen. And if you have a good microscopist, it gives you a good presumptive identification. I won't brag, but there's a lot of microbiology techs out there that can look down at a wound swab and indicate to the doctor with good certainty that this swab has staph in it. Staph is growing in this because of the clumping gram-positive bacteria that you can see. And I have some slides coming up here of various organisms under the microscope, and hopefully you'll be able to see some of the changes. We can also interpret the quality of the specimen. What we're looking for from, for instance, a wound swab, the lab tech is looking to see what kind of bacteria are present and if there are any pus cells or polymorphonuclear white blood cells, polymorphs, and if there's epithelial cells. Because if you start finding a lot of epithelial cells, especially in a wound swab, the quality of the specimen is probably not that great. In a specimen like sputum that has to come up the respiratory tract from the lungs through the mouth and out again, if you pick up a lot of flora from the mouth, the specimen will show a lot of epithelial or squamous epithelial cells that line the cheeks. And to the laboratory, we're showing that's probably not the greatest specimen in the world. So it's a good way for us to interpret the quality of the specimen by taking a look under the microscope. And I just happened to notice today, I was reading some results, and the laboratory that I'm affiliated with was reporting a wound swab to me. And their preamble said, the lack of inflammatory cells may indicate poor quality sample, and therefore any organism isolated must be interpreted in light of the clinical features. And I'll talk about this a little bit later, about the significance of normal versus abnormal flora and the quality of your specimen. This laboratory goes basically is putting that right up front for everyone that looks at the requisition, and it's saying, we saw a lot of epithelial cells on here, we didn't see much pus cells on here, it's going to be a questionable specimen, so treat everything that comes up with a little bit of thought as to what was showing up with the patient. So we look at what's normal and abnormal, and again, there's a lot of specimens we won't do a gram stain on that have just too much normal flora. For instance, there would be no reason to do a gram stain on a throat specimen looking for group A streptococci causing a pharyngitis because the mouth is full of gram-positive cocci and chains, all your regular stuff that you should find there. So it's not going to help us to do a gram stain on various specimens, and you may see that on requisitions that a gram stain is not performed on the specimen. On the next slide, we talk about antibiotic therapy. Because your gram stain is based on cell wall composition, if we can say to a doctor, in this body fluid, there are a lot of gram-negative rods, we don't have to tell them whether it's E. coli or whether it's Klebsiella. We may be able to say anaerobic, aerobic, depending on the shape of them and what they look like, but the doctor can direct antibiotic therapy by knowing that this organism has a gram-negative cell wall, and I've got an antibiotic that affects cell wall synthesis based on the gram-negative. They can direct the therapy just from a gram stain. So it's a very quick turnaround time with gram stains. I've already talked about the normal flora. If there's tons of it being present, it's not very helpful. We will not do gram stains on stool specimens. I did once, and it's very interesting to see the number of variety of bacteria that actually come out of a stool specimen, but that gets probably back to my physics of flying feces talk that I did earlier. What had actually happened is I was looking for white blood cells in a stool specimen to see whether the patient might have had something that was causing his diarrhea that was causing an inflammatory response. And while looking at this wet prep where I'd taken some saline on a slide, added a bit of stool to it and stuck it on my microscope to look, and those of you that have used a microscope realize that the stage is about 2.5 inches from your nose. So it's not a pleasant thing to do to the lab tech. But I noticed a lot of organisms that were motile that were doing this nice corkscrew motion through the background of what I was looking at. And I did a gram stain on it, and the stool was full of spiral bacteria. And I said to the doctor, if this patient has diarrhea and you're suspicious of a bacterial infection, there's a good chance this is Campylobacter. And, of course, I had to explain myself because he couldn't figure out how I could do that from a gram stain, and it turned out I was right. I haven't told you about all the times I was wrong, but at this one time I was right. Gram stains are very significant on sterile body sites where you don't expect to find bacteria. If the specimen has not been contaminated, your gram stain can get antibiotic therapy directed very quickly, especially from something like a cerebrospinal fluid or other body fluids. We had a case of a patient that was in with a suspected meningococcemia, where the patient had Neisseria meningitidis that normally causes meningitis in his bloodstream. And he had presented as extremely unwell and was developing the rash that is very typical of this organism. And we were able to actually inject a little bit of saline into the one of these small rash spots or the petechiae, aspirate it back into the syringe, put it on a slide, do a Gram stain, and we saw an organism consistent with Neisseria meningitidis on inside the white blood cells of this patient. And it just helped the doctor. We're pretty sure what it was, but again, it gave him a really good idea of what antibiotic to get on board. The Gram stain also helps with the interpretation of the culture results. If we see something in the Gram stain, we should see it coming up on the plate. And the lab tech works back and forth with that information. And the doctor should also, too, that if we're reporting something else that's not seen on the Gram stain, you should have a nice, happy picture when you put the two of these together. So the next slides are photomicrographs. Again, I apologize to those of you that only have black and white. The four people here with me in the room have a little bit more benefit of seeing the first slide, which is gram-positive cocci in chains. They do clump together, but that's just thicker areas of the slides. I would refer to this as gram-positive cocci in chains. The next slide that I looked at is a much clearer picture of gram-positive cocci in chains. When I look at this up close on my screen here, there's actually a very fine halo around each of these chains, which would make me more suspicious of this being something along the lines of Streptococcus pneumoniae, because I know that organism does produce a capsule around the organism, so I can actually see that in the Gram stain. The clumpy things in the background, both in black and white and in color here, are white blood cells. Some of these do look like polymorphonuclear. Some of them look like they're mononuclear, which varies as to what the organism might be also. The next slide has gram-positive cocci in pairs. This is Streptococcus pneumoniae because they're generally around in pairs. Some of them are flattened on the sides. There's lots of white blood cells kicking around in the background here. The fourth slide that I've got, which actually goes on to another page, are gram-positive rods. Again, they're purple. And the one on the upper left actually has a swelling at the end, which looks like it's got a spore in it. So again, I would be suspicious that this would be a Clostridia organism because it carries spores. Depending on what body site it came out of, it could also be a Bacillus species, which is an aerobic organism that produces spores. But again, a conversation with the doctor, we can say we've got gram-positive rods with spores and let the doctor utilize that information. The next slide again shows gram-positive rods with spores. You can see the clearing areas on the end of some of these. It doesn't quite show up well in black and white, unfortunately. The slide after that is labeled intracellular gram-negative diplococci. This is something I was very used to seeing when I worked in a laboratory that processed urethral smears from a sexually transmitted infection clinic. And what they would do at the clinic is express some pus from the urethra, put it on a slide, send it to us, we would stain it. And you would find intracellular, which means inside the cell, gram-negative diplococci. And this is basically diagnostic of Neisseria gonorrhea. If this was a CSF, this is diagnostic of Neisseria meningitidis. Because it's just a very typical picture. There are other organisms that could be similar to this. It has to be tied into the entire presentation that comes along, but it's a neat little slide. It was always, unfortunately, entertaining for the microbiology tech because you don't get to see this too often, but it usually means the patient is quite sick. The next slide is going to talk about biochemical identification. So once we know what the organism looks like, we can start tying that into what can it do with the sugars and other substrates that we give to it. Does it ferment them? Does it oxidize them? Or does it use an enzyme to break down some of this? Most of this is now automated. It is done through cards or strips, and a machine reads this for us and gives us results much quicker than what we used to get by incubating for 18 to 24 hours. The next slide is one of the systems. I'm not saying one system is better than the other. I just happen to have this slide available to me, which is the API system. At the bottom of the slide here, you can see a strip. There's 20 wells that have a variety of substrates on the left-hand side. The first one on the right-hand side has a little black dot in it, and that's a hunk of gelatin, actually, with charcoal particles to see if the organism can actually produce a gelatinase enzyme. And the nine at the end of that are all various sugars. In color, and actually in black and white, the lighter tubes on the right-hand side are showing that there was a fermentation reaction that actually happened. The blue color indicates that the organism could not break down that sugar. And then it's a code system. Each cup is assigned a certain value. You add it up, you end up with a code, and you can identify the organism fairly accurately and fairly reproducibly using a system like this. Once we know the organism's name, or a good idea of its genus anyway, so if we know we have a staph species, for instance, and it's from a significant body site or an isolate that we think needs to have sensitivity testing done on, we will try to find out what antibiotic should be used for this organism. This process is very simple. We take the organism, we put it in the presence of the antibiotic, and we see if it kills it. We do it very reproducibly in very standardized ways. We take little pieces of paper that have been impregnated with the antibiotic at a known concentration. We put the organism on a plate, drop these pieces of paper on, and see if there is no growth around the disc out to a certain distance, because the antibiotic would leach into the agar and kill the organism. There are also freeze-dried microwells where you make the organism up in a suspension, add it to the microwells, and again incubate. Many of these now are read by machines to give you an idea of what is actually, when it is growing and when it's not. Some turnaround testing and the sensitivity testing can be as quick as 4 hours with these machines. Most of them end up taking up to 24 hours to give you a definitive result. The picture of the Kirby Bauer plate here, again named after the two doctors that standardized this, is what I was describing, where you take the organism in pure growth, put it into a suspension, spread it entirely over the surface of the plate, and then add various discs. This one has 3, 6, 9, 12 discs on it. Put the discs on, throw it in the incubator overnight so that the organism grows. The antibiotic leaches out of each of these little tabs that we have on here. They're all labeled with various short forms of what antibiotics they are. And then we know how far the antibiotic goes in a certain length of time, what the concentration is as you get farther out, because the farther away from the disc, the less concentrated the antibiotic is. And there is set standards that we follow that are very tightly controlled as to how big that zone has to be. And we take the ruler, as is in the picture here, and measure across the disc from side to side, with the disc being in the middle, and measure the number of millimeters that are showing there. If it's a certain number of millimeters, it's sensitive. If it's a certain number of millimeters, it's intermediate. And if it's not enough millimeters, we call it resistant to that antibiotic. So this is one manual way of actually doing the test. The automated way, again, I just happen to have these slides from the same company that had the other strip. Each of the little wells inside there have either a biochemical reagent or an antibiotic at a known dilution. The organism is made up in a suspension, put inside the card. The card's read every 10 minutes or so, and as soon as it has an identification and enough growth to say sensitive or resistant, it will then give you the results. This is a very simplified way of doing antibiotic testing. There's also other ways of doing things which shows you the actual MIC, or minimum inhibitory concentration, that I'm not going to talk into today. When we start getting into the E-test and other ways of doing that, it's more than what I really wanted to talk about today. Suffice it to say, we put the organism in the presence of an antibiotic and find out what's going to kill it. So my next slide, another slide that I discovered in PowerPoint, you got some really neat graphics that you can do, is how we name things. The way I started this is I start with the Gram reaction. And if it's based on a Gram positive, if I move to the left here, I look at whether the organism can grow aerobically or anaerobically, and whether it's cocci or bacilli. So I can have a Gram positive aerobic cocci, if I come across the top and hit the first cocci, or a Gram positive aerobic bacilli, Gram positive anaerobic cocci, and the same on the other side. Gram-negative organisms, whether they're aerobic or anaerobic, cocci or bacilli. And this is my basic scheme of how I name things, based on my Gram reaction and how it grows in the presence of oxygen or not. And this will keep coming up because I will refer to organisms as these Gram-positive cocci or these aerobic Gram-negative whatevers. And it just shows you how what I'm actually saying here and how it flows through the organisms. I probably should have minimized this and have it on each of the next slides as I talk about the various organisms that we work with. So if I want to look at groups of organisms, I'm going to start by talking about our Gram-positive organisms. So my Gram-positive aerobic cocci include organisms such as Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, and Enterococcus. The Strep and Enterococcus truly are facultative anaerobic. They grow and produce much better hemolysis when they're done anaerobically, but they do grow aerobically. So we could probably have an argument whether I should actually have a classification of Gram-positive facultative anaerobic cocci. We just generally don't go there. So the Gram-positive anaerobic cocci include names such as Peptostreptococcus and Peptococcus. And again, I apologize, these names are changing rapidly enough. I don't even know if these two genuses still exist. My Gram-positive aerobic bacilli, they grow in the presence of oxygen, they're purple rods, are organisms such as Bacillus, Listeria, Crinibacterium, and Erysipelathrix. A lot of these I put up here only because I can pronounce them and the vast majority of you can't, and it's always fun to do that. Oh yes, I'm showing off, I know. My Gram-positive anaerobic bacilli are your Clostridium and your Propionibacterium. This is where the names come from. So when you hear Clostridium, you probably just think Clostridium difficile. I'm thinking it's a purple rod that only grows without oxygen. So the microbiology mind tends to look at these things all slightly differently. And I think that's why you find infection control professionals that are lab techs tend to have a slightly different look at all of these things, because we know what they look like on the plate. We've played with them. We've got them to tell us what they can do. And it's just a different perspective on life some days. Your gram negative on the next slide, aerobic cocci, so still sticking with my round organisms here, are organisms such as Neisseria and Moraxella, which used to be called Ranumnella, which used to be called Neisseria also. Moraxella is one of those groups that seems to change its name every year and a half or so. You're probably more familiar with it as Moraxella catarrhalis, causes some pneumonia in adults and children. Your gram-negative aerobic rods, organisms such as Haemophilus, I've got an asterisk on there because many microbiology techs would argue with me that they're actually coccobacilli. They're actually little rods and little cocci. They're sort of halfway in between. I like to put them under aerobic bacilli myself. Your Pseudomonas and your Stenotrophomonas fall underneath here as aerobic organisms. Stenotrophomonas has been through numerous name changes. He started out as a Pseudomonas multifilia, and then he went to Xanthomonas multifilia, and then we decided to change it to Stenotrophomonas multifilia. As a bench tech, I'm not quite sure why we changed the name so many times, but that's what we're stuck with right now. I don't know if he's changed his name recently also or not. So my gram-negative, red-looking, facultative anaerobic, they can grow either air or not air, are organisms such as your Escherichia, your Klebsiella, your Enterobacter, organisms that are present in the gut. Your gram-negative aerobic rods are names such as Prevotella and Bacteroides species. So this is how, when you start hearing the names, I'm trying to give you the visual of what we see in the laboratory. So let's start looking at some of the specific organisms. Your staphylococci, gram-positive, organisms, catalase positive. I've talked about the coagulase, dividing them into two groups. And the coagulase ability helps Staph aureus be such a good pathogen because it's able to take plasma that's present in the organism that it's infecting, you and I, and cover itself a little bit because it can take the plasma that's floating around it and try to evade the treatment that we're trying to give it. All of your staphylococci are potential pathogens. When I first studied the staphylococci in the late 70s, we always considered Staph aureus to be the pathogen. When we started being able to implant devices in people, we recognized that all of the coagulase negative staph can also be potential pathogens. I have a picture of Staph aureus sitting on a blood agar plate in color. It's more or less typical of what I'm used to seeing. Staph aureus, the aureus part of it usually means gold. It's the basis of where that name comes from, and many times in your plate it actually does have a golden color to it. Your staphylococci on the next slide here can be normal flora. Staph aureus hangs out in the nose, skin, vagina, rectum, feces, and mouth of a lot of people. So just isolating it in the laboratory does not mean antibiotics are required. Your coagulase negative staph are considered skin flora. When we find them in blood or sterile body fluids, we need to take a good look at whether they are coming from the skin or whether they're actually causing a problem. And this gets back to how did we take the specimen? Did we use a good antiseptic on the skin for something like a blood culture? Your strep and enterococci, gram-positive cocci in chains, the coagulase, or sorry, catalase negative. Really, the strep are facultative anaerobic, as I commented on. Your normal flora ones generally are alpha-hemolytic. And present in the mouth. Streptococcus pneumoniae, which is an alpha-hemolytic streptococci, can be normal flora. Your pathogenic ones are generally beta-hemolytic. Your groups A through G are the human potential pathogens. So you've got group A strep that causes pharyngitis. Your group B strep that would cause your neonatal sepsis. And group C and G are sometimes considered to be possible pathogens of pharyngitis. That is still an argument that goes back and forth. I always considered if they're present in heavy growth with no other pathogen present that they're probably causing the pharyngitis. Group F falls in the middle. There is no group E. Group D used to be all of your enterococci is where they fell in. These groups are all were work done by Dr. Lansfield. These are the Lansfield groups, and she was able to divide out the different groups based on how they reacted here and by doing some testing to look at the cell wall. I've got another slide here of beta-hemolytic streptococci with the clearing around. The organism itself is a little on the orange side here, which is how I remember group B strep looking, causing neonatal sepsis. Your enterococci, generally speaking, are gut flora. These, in the old days, as I commented, this used to be the group D, as in Don, streptococci. Most of what people pass per rectum can be enterococci. This is really important when we talk about VRE, and as Paul mentioned, refer back to my other presentation. When we start seeing VRE being passed around, we generally have some problem with how we're handling feces. Thank goodness the enterococci generally are not very virulent. They don't cause a lot of illness. They do cause some urinary tract infections. You find them in fecally contaminated abscesses. And we're seeing the resistant problem, as I'm sure everyone is well-versed in terms of the vancomycin-resistant enterococci, where the enterococci have developed or inherited resistance to the vancomycin antibiotic. Gram-negatives, I'm going to talk about next. Let's start with the gram-negative cocci or coccobacilli, depending on where you lie and how you look at the gram stain, are Neisseria species. The two main human pathogens are gonorrhea and Neisseria meningitidis. There are other organisms. I've listed two that I remember playing with in the laboratory, Neisseria lactamica and Neisseria sicca, which are generally found up in the mouth. And we had to be clear when we're working with sputum specimens whether this is a possible pathogen or not. Generally speaking, it's considered normal flora. Moraxella catarrhalis, I've talked about the different name changes and stuff like that, cause of pneumonia. Haemophilus is the coccobacilli on the next slide, normal flora of the nose and throat. It has a neat ability to actually not grow on regular blood agar, but if on that blood agar you put a streak of Staph aureus, it will grow right around the staph because the staph liberates some compounds from the plate to allow the organism to grow. Haemophilus has fairly finicky growth requirements with that. It likes a little bit of increased carbon dioxide to help it grow better. It likes to grow on something we call a chocolate agar, where we take the blood, break all the red blood cells, so it actually literally looks like chocolate, and that way all the nutrients that are present inside the red blood cell are available for it. Now, Haemophilus was one of the leading causes of meningitis in children, probably still is in some parts of the world, but in North America, with the HIV vaccine, we don't see a lot of this problem anymore. However, we are starting to see some problems with other groups of the Haemophilus influenza. Group B, which the vaccine covers, has been taken care of, but we're now starting to see problems with the other groups. Again, in the world, if we create a niche, somebody's going to come in and fill it. The next slide does show some satellite growth around the staph streak. In many plates where you're trying to find out whether Haemophilus is present or not, as you set up the blood agar plate and you do that streaking that I showed you way back in some of the early slides, you literally put staph aureus on the plate on purpose because that'll help you see whether this is growing. A specimen like an eye swab, we would do all the time, put the staph streak on just to see if the organism's there. And it gives us a really quick presumptive identification. Your Enterobacteriaceae are organisms found, generally speaking, in the gut, gram-negative facultative anaerobic rods. So you now know what that all means, our little pink rod-shaped guys. All of your Enterobacteriaceae, one of the characteristics of the group is they can ferment glucose. They are catalase positive. Many, as I said, are gut flora. Many cause nosocomial infection. Gut flora, nosocomial infections. Problems with feces. I keep seeing this come up, and I'm surprised Paul asked me back because I'm starting to sound like a one-trick pony here. The term, many of these bugs are referred to as coliforms, or meaning from the colon. So you will hear many times people refer to some of these organisms as coliform bacteria, and that's where the expression is coming from. We grow these organisms and can get them to do things in something called a McConkie agar, which is a selective differential agar. Selective meaning it kills off a bunch of normal bugs that would be there, allowing only your gram-negative rods to grow through. And it's differential in that it has in it lactose and a pH indicator system. On the next slide, I've got pictures of three different McConkie plates. The top one is showing us a lactose non-fermenter. And the two bottom plates that are red, those of you without the color, I apologize again, but the two bottom ones are actually the colonies grow up red because of the indicator that is present, and they have fermented the lactose producing the acid end products. The organisms on the left are nice dried looking. They're actually pretty typical looking of E. coli. The organisms on the right, it doesn't show up well again, unfortunately, in the black and white, but they're actually very mucoid. And if I touch this with one of my wires in the laboratory and drew it away, you actually get a little string of mucus that comes up off these organisms. I've seen a variety of organisms that can produce this mucus around them. Typically, I would call that Klebsiella pneumoniae. It's one of the more typical ones that I remember doing that. But there are many mucoid colony types of organisms, such as E. coli, that I've also seen pull away like that. So the next slide is going to talk about the Enterobacteriaceae, a variety of names that hopefully are familiar to you, Klebsiella, Citrobacter, Enterobacter, Proteus, Morganella, Providentia. These are the genus names. The species names change constantly, such as E. coli. Klebsiella, I know, has numerous species. Each of these probably have anywhere from 2 to 10 different species names depending on what you're looking at, or they just create a new genus based on one common characteristic. Serratia at the end there is one of our more important, but to me is an important nosocomial organism, because Serratia is one of the bugs that is able to grow in disinfectants that have become contaminated. So when I start seeing Serratia showing up, I have concerns about how well we are cleaning. One small flurry that I saw once, I found that over a holiday period, I'd had substitute housekeepers filling in the department, and one of the doctors told me, we've got some Serratia growing out of endotracheal secretions here. And when I went and talked to my housekeeper, I said, how were things over the holidays? And she had a great break, and I said, how were things when you got back? And she didn't want to say anything, and she finally admitted to me that it had taken her 10 to 15 minutes to scrub out her mop bucket to get it to clean and get rid of the slime layer that was inside of it. And as soon as she did that, the Serratia all disappeared. So it's one of these organisms that can actually grow very well in the presence of various, not necessarily antibiotics, but in terms of cleaning solutions. The next line, the Shigella, Salmonella, Yersinia, are all of our enteric pathogens that are can be foodborne or waterborne, cause diarrhea. They have, all of the Enterobacteriaceae has a variety of different pathogenic mechanisms. They can be invasive, they can produce toxin. Whenever you see these organisms coming up where they shouldn't be, think of feces. That's my infection control plug on these organisms here. The other gram-negatives on the next slide, as I talk about, when I see Pseudomonas from my infection control background, I'm always thinking water. There's something moist around that is allowing these organisms to grow. If you swab the base of any sink tap, that has moisture accumulated there, you're going to find Pseudomonas. It just loves being in a moist environment. Pseudomonas generally, to me, are environmental bugs. They survive well in the environment. They can grow in water as pure as distilled water. They don't need a lot of stuff to survive. Stenomonas maltophilia, Stenotrophomonas maltophilia. When we were having some issues with that in one of the areas I used to work in, they discovered the only place they could find it was consistently was in the sink drains. And something that we started adding in was every 3 weeks we poured about half a gallon of white vinegar down the sink drain. And I think a combination of the vinegar broke down any slime that was present in the drain, and it seemed to take care of the problem. So something we've never actually reproduced, because we don't really want Stenomonas maltophilia running around in our hospitals. Another name that's starting to pop up more and more, especially in the literature that I'm seeing, is Acinetobacter. He has numerous combinations of names. When I first learned about him, he was known as Acinetobacter calcolaceticus var anatratus, or variant Loafi. To me, I'm always thinking oral contamination when I find this in places it's really not supposed to be. What we're finding now is a lot of these Acinetobacters are extremely pan-resistant. No matter what antibiotic you test them against, they are resistant. And they're becoming quite a concern from a nosocomial perspective, because if we pass this along and it gets into an area that we just can't let the body fight it off, we've got a very bad infection that's going to happen. So our Clostridia, I'm going to move along to the gram-positive anaerobic bacteria. We've got spore-bearing organisms. All of the Clostridia carry a spore of one form or another. Vast majority. So your Clostridium perfringens, that causes gas gangrene, Clostridium difficile, we're all well versed in as to the problems it causes in our hospitals because of the spore and its ability to survive harsh environmental conditions. Clostridium tetani, which causes tetanus, which we don't see too much of because of the vaccination that we're able to do. There, that was a quick tour of the anaerobic gram-positive rods. On to yeasts. I'm just trying to mention some more of the clinically significant organisms here, and I've got a slide coming up on the stuff that I just won't have time to get to today for a basic microbiology overview. Yeasts are a problem, single-cell organisms. There's numerous species that causes problems, the more common one being Candida albicans. Candida albicans is identified by using something called a germ tube test, where we put the organism in some serum or plasma, incubate it for 4 hours, and if it's Candida albicans, the little cell itself produces a tube that we refer to as a germ tube. It almost looks like a root coming out of it. Generally, they are opportunistic organisms. They are normal flora in the upper respiratory tract. They can cause they're also normal flora in the vagina, as a matter of fact. But they do cause problems in urinary, vaginal yeast infections, and systemic infections in the extremely ill. When you start getting yeast out of blood cultures, you've got some problems with the patient. The next picture is a small photomicrograph of germ tubes being produced by the little purple cells. They've been incubated for the 4 hours. We take a drop of the serum, put it on the slide, take a look at it, and see whether it's got germ tubes or not. And it's just a definitive identification that we used to use for Candida albicans. Moving on to the mycobacterium, these are a little bit different, and I wanted to touch on them because of some of the differences. They don't stain with the Gram stain. Their cell wall composition, their cell wall composition is such that the gram stain can't penetrate it. So we discovered that if you took a much stronger solution, so you take some phenol and mix it with basic fusion, one of our stains, you end up with something called carbol fusion, put it on the slide and actually heat it literally with a Bunsen burner until it starts to steam, and keep it heated for 5 minutes. So you're actually cooking the stain into the organism. We then used to take hydrochloric acid mixed in alcohol and put it on top of the organism for 5 minutes, or on top of the slide, washing it several times to get rid of all the stain that would come off. If the organism can tolerate that combination of acid and alcohol, we refer to it as acid fast. And that's where the name acid fast bacteria comes from. It's just a staining technique we use. Once we get rid of all the stain, we add a counter stain that, generally speaking, was green or blue in color. And then you would have to look at it under a microscope. So your Mycobacterium tuberculosis, or MTB, is a well-recognized pathogen worldwide. And with the advent of immunosuppression, either through viral infection or when we start doing it with chemotherapeutic agents and stuff, we've started to find there's a lot of opportunistic Mycobacterium, one of them being MAI, or your Mycobacterium avium intracellulari. I've got a photomicrograph here. The arrow is actually pointing at some acid-fast bacilli. When I used to read these slides in the days of confirming that the organism was actually present, it was mind-boggling work to sit and try to look for this little bit of red going past this lovely blue background. We actually did come up with a fluorescent stain to make this much easier, where we stained the organism same way, but we just used a different stain, washed it with the acid solution, but we could use a microscope that had a black light on it. So you're actually looking for something that would glow in the dark. But that, again, was no fun to do right after lunch, because you're sitting in a dark room looking at a black background waiting to see something go by that had some color to it. So I'm not saying I ever put my head down, but I probably should. Mycobacterium are very slow-growing bacteria. A lot of your Enterobacteriaceae, things like E. coli, in optimum conditions will reproduce every 20 minutes, and hence we can get a lot of colony growth over the course of an overnight. Your Mycobacterium are very slow to divide, maybe once every 24 hours. So when we are trying to grow these on solid media, we will retain the media for up to 8 weeks to see if we can see the visible colonies or not. There are environmental species that can contaminate our specimens that are acid fast that can show up, and we've seen many pseudo outbreaks of tuberculosis, people thought, and then it turns out to be things like Mycobacterium gerdoni, or the tap water bacillus, as it's also known as. Mycobacterium marinum can cause issues for people that cut their arms on the inside of fish tanks, and it will cause a granuloma to show up that actually needs treatment from a Mycobacterium perspective. MOT is another expression that is used, and it stands for Mycobacterium other than TB. And this is referring to the whole other group of organisms that exist under the name Mycobacterium that can cause human illness, but it's not tuberculosis. So some unusual organisms that I wanted to talk about, we have things like mycoplasma that I'm probably just getting over right now. They're atypical organisms because they don't truly have a cell wall. It's more of a cell membrane. They don't grow or stain well. We have to use different techniques and different medias to grow them up, and it's something that usually there has to be a special request specifically for mycoplasma. And again, our DNA probes and PCR testing will help us a lot with these organisms. Ureaplasma urealyticum is another one of those organisms, and the chlamydia sort of fall into this atypical group of organisms, your chlamydia pneumoniae and chlamydia trachomatis causing the infections listed here. I did want to talk briefly about viruses, and the people that have joined me here today have said, are you going to talk about viruses? So I will talk a little bit about them. Viruses are not like bacteria. They are not little bacteria, because they are totally different that way. They do not grow or divide as such. They make copies of themselves. They're little intracellular pirates that come in, take over the cell's ability to utilize things. They make copies of themselves, burst out of the cells, and continue on their merry way. On the next slide, I talk about them being an obligate intracellular parasite, or the pirate of the cell is where that expression comes from. They're really not a cellular organism. They don't have any other organelles. They don't have ribosomes. They really are energy-less, which is very interesting that way. And they're not free-living as such. They do survive outside of a host, but they need host cells to actually reproduce. So when you have an organism like norovirus present in the environment due to environmental soiling and not cleaning properly, it's not going to keep reproducing as it sits there. It's waiting for you to come along, inoculate yourself through the fecal-oral route, allow it to find the cells that it likes to reproduce in. It'll start to do that and causes its problems that we're all well-versed in. The viruses are classified into two main groups. There's two ways of doing it, both by DNA and RNA viruses, and then there's also enveloped and non-enveloped viruses. To me, it's never intuitive that an enveloped virus is easier to kill and is less hardy. To me, something that's inside an envelope should be much more rigorous, but it's not. And the way I got my head wrapped around that is your non-enveloped viruses have to be hardy to survive. They don't have that protection around, so they've become really tough. They're used to living in pretty nasty neighborhoods. And they're resistant to lower concentrations of alcohol. This issue keeps coming up in literature that if you're worried about things like norovirus, which is a non-envelope virus, you have to make sure you're using a good concentration of alcohol in your hand sanitizers. You have to make sure you have a good contact time of at least 15 seconds. And that you also want to make sure that if your hands are grossly soiled with something like vomit or feces, that you want to wash. Because the alcohol is not going to be effective through all of those things, such as having something on your hands and having the virus itself. So it's something to keep in mind when you're in the middle of a norovirus outbreak that you want to make sure you have the strongest alcohol around that you can find. I do have a slide here on normal flora. I wanted to talk about that a positive culture doesn't necessarily mean that you have an infection going on. There's many organisms that are part of normal flora that can be potential pathogens. Most any part of your body that communicates with the external environment have bacteria on them. There's not a lot of the body that is truly sterile. And on the next slide, I have a picture of a blood agar plate with mixed flora on it. I've got some coliform organisms, the big juicy things there, a whole bunch of probably skin flora of various types. This could be a swab of many different things to grow this. It could be a sputum specimen from an intubated patient with a little bit of coliform growing up in it, a variety of things that this could actually be. I put a slide up on here that you can look at your leisure because there's a lot of stuff on here, but it's a list of what could be found as normal flora in the vagina. And the organisms listed are mind-boggling that are just present as normal flora. And a lot of this can be a combination of fecal contamination of the vagina just due to the proximity of the anus. We have aerobic organisms, we have anaerobic organisms, we have yeast that is present. 15 to 30% of normal vaginal flora can be yeast. Or you can find it in 30 to 40% of normal vaginas. It just gives you an idea that just because we isolate a pathogen from something, we have to consider where it's from and other organisms that might be around. Normal respiratory flora on the next slide include lots of anaerobes. We have the streptococci. We have Neisseria species, including Neisseria meningitidis, the organism that we all relate to meningococcus or meningitis. We have the Crinibacterium group that I haven't talked about, Haemophilus species. This is all normal stuff, and it's all of these can be potential pathogens in something like a sputum specimen, or all of these could cause pneumonia, especially if we have an aspiration pneumonia. Normal respiratory flora that we find normally, again, are all these recognized pathogens, Streptococcus pneumoniae, Haemophilus influenza, our group A streptococci, Moraxella, the Enterobacteria ACA, and yeast. So I always caution everyone when you're reading a microbiology report that just because we have a pathogen doesn't mean the patient needs antibiotics. It could be normal flora. Things that are never normal flora, your Mycobacterium tuberculosis you really don't want to find. Legionella species are generally not carried in the sputum or lungs as normal flora. Brucella, those of you that are working with bioterrorism agents recognize that you should never find Brucella in a specimen unless you can tie it back to either animal contact or we've got something else going on. You've got some normal flora or pathogenic organisms that may be asymptomatic. They're not normally found, but they may not be actually producing symptoms. And we have a lot of asymptomatic carriers of Neisseria gonorrhea, Salmonella species, Bacillus anthracis we can find, but people may not know that they actually carry it around. Some of the organisms that we won't get to, as I look at my time here running up, there's a whole series of anaerobes that can take up another full hour, are actinomyces, which are, again, gram-positive rods that have their special growth characteristics. Gardnerella, an organism that can cause bacterial vaginosis or is associated as part of bacterial vaginosis, are more sensitive organisms to grow in the laboratory but absolutely deadly in our patients, such as Brucella, Francisella, and Bordetella, myparasites, and fungus. So in summary, the names may change, but the bugs stay the same. They're always there. Don't get mad at the laboratory. Somebody else down the road at a research lab is changing these names on us, and we do our best to stay up to speed on them. Micro is not a rapid science, and there's a lot of the science that we don't have a lot of control around. You have to send down a good swab to the laboratory to get good results back. I used to say garbage on, garbage out, relating to the computer term of garbage in, garbage out. If we don't get a good swab, the lab only tells you what they're actually seeing. I'd like to thank Dr. Toy, that used to be up at the Ottawa Hospital. I didn't follow up if he's still up there or not. Some of the slides around viral pathogens and some of the photomicrographs I have borrowed from him with his permission. And I think that is the end of my presentation.
Jim, a pro as always, bringing us right under the wire. Thank you very much. And let me say, I'm glad that this lecture is being recorded and will be posted on the website, because I'm definitely going to need a second listen, or a third or a fourth listen as well, to catch all of that. Thank you very much. During this presentation, Jim mentioned a couple of company names, and I'd like to point out that the Teleclass Education Program doesn't endorse or advertise any company, and mention of a product or company should not be considered an endorsement. Thank you again to all of you for joining this teleclass. A special thank you, Jim. You did an amazing job, as always, and I think this is going to be, again, one of the most popular online recordings, as is your Physics of Flying Feces recording. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul.
Until again, everyone, thank you for joining us, and we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.